Welcome to Chicano Highlights. Today we have a very special guest, Evan Greenspans. How are you doing?
Oh, fine. Glad to be out here.
All right. We're going to start off with your background. Where are your parents from?
My parents are both born in L.A. Their parents were born in Eastern Europe, and they have older siblings that were born in Canada, but both of them were born in the 1920s in Los Angeles here.
All right. And do you have any brothers and sisters?
I have an older sister, and she moved to Germany, and that's where she's living now in Berlin.
All right. So where did you go to school?
I went to school at Hamilton High School in L.A. and on to UCLA, where I got a bachelor's degree in sociology.
Wow. Okay. And did you go on and get further education after that?
No, I didn't. I basically went on to save the world. For 6 years, I was off on my own. And then my father came to me. We have a family business called Greenspans in Southgate, California. And I grew up working in that. And he told me he's going to close down the business or I'm going to come in. And being engaged at the time, it sounded like a good idea, and unemployed. So I came back into the family business, and I've been working in that business ever since.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your father and the business. How did this start?
It started with his father in 1928. My father grew up in the back of this store, which is in Watts, California, and on 103rd Street. And they were open 7 days a week sold men's clothing, ladies' clothing, shoes, yardage, started later carrying appliances. It was called Greenspan's Department Store, and it was a fixture on 103rd Street in Watts. Then my father, at age 13, opened up a new branch of it in Southgate, where we're presently located, with having a 62-year-old man working for him while he was going to junior high.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he went into the service, his parents closed down the Watts store, and Southgate was growing and made Southgate the main store. And it's been on the same corner of Tweedy and Elizabeth since that time. And he came out of the service, and his parents retired, and he continued the business, molding it into what we have today.
Okay. Now, your father was in the service. What branch?
He was in the Army. He served in the Philippines and New Guinea during World War II, and then with the relocation of the Japanese troops that were stationed in Korea after the war.
Okay. And why was a store, I guess, fashionable for him? Why didn't he go on to school or do something else?
Well, school was difficult for him. He was practical from his point of view, and he felt he'd like to get an education. He was a talented artist, had a scholarship offered to him to Art Center of Los Angeles, but he felt he just needed to make a living. And after the Army, he was offered a piece of a Las Vegas casino in 1947. But his parents, who were gamblers, and knew people like Bugsy Siegel, felt it probably wasn't good for his health to go into competition with Bugsy Siegel.
No, it wasn't.
No, what his mother said is, you'll never get rich in the clothing business, but when you start up your car, it'll either start up or not start up. It won't blow up.
Good advice. Good advice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so then he came back, he opened up the store, and he continued. Now, tell me, you've been working at this store for how long?
Off and on for 49 years.
All right. Tell me about fashions and how fashions have changed.
Well, when I started dusting boxes and picking up pins at age 5, It was the 1960s, and fashions were very tight. It was narrow pants, narrow bottoms, small lapels, small brims, short collars. Things were very conservative. It was the Ivy League kind of look. We had some of the Pachuco look in our store, more the Veterano kind of look as well, but things were very conservative. Things were very rigid. A lot of conformity was required, and especially in Southgate, which is a very, 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 very conservative town mm-hmm. at that time.
And that's changed, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Southgate was primarily a white town in the 1950s with John Birch Society and Minutemen, very ultra-right wing that didn't want to take federal funds because they didn't want Big Brother controlling them. It was a odd community. A man came into my father's store and asked him where all the intellectuals hung out. And he came home and thought it was a weird request and told my sister, you know, what the man said. And she said, well, did you tell him in a phone booth?
Okay.
It was even sort of scarier than that at times. Southgate used to brag that no black ever spent the night in Southgate in the 1950s.
Wow. Wow. Now, that slowly changed. Tell me about that.
Well, on one side of town, there was a Firestone rubber plant and a General Motors plant, and those plants closed down. And there was temporary worker housing that slowly got rented out to Latinos. So while Southgate was busy keeping blacks out, Latinos started moving in.
Mm.
And so one side of town became predominantly Latino, and the rest of the town was predominantly white. And then there was a panic among some of the white residents and de facto white flight out to places like Elsinore and Hemet. And it became primarily Latino. But what's interesting is that the people on that side of town were very much discriminated against by the city and the police because they were Latino and they were thought all to be gangsters and troublemakers. And then the town became majority Latino. And a lot of times people on that side of town are discriminated against and felt that they're gangsters and troublemakers. The complexion of the city has changed, but some of the attitudes haven't.
Exactly, exactly. Now, going back to fashion school, we didn't finish up. We talked mm-hmm. about the 60s, and then it changed from the 70s and the 80s.
Then in the 70s, we became more of a center for these new Latino residents and the black and Latino residents of Watts and Compton as a place to find original classic styles. So as polyester came in the 70s and the long collars and all the things you see in that 70s show, in the 70s, Greenspan sold very little of that. We catered to our customers that loved the styles of the 1940s and 50s, the Zoot Suit look, the Pachuco look, the Ricky Ricardo look. And so in Greenspan's, we were sort of like a time warp where we were out getting original, unused clothes from that era, buying out my father's buddies' back rooms and warehouses, factories, Spiegel catalog of all the old things that people who would just wear polyester didn't want. They didn't want cottons at the time. They didn't want wools. That was old-fashioned, and old-fashioned was very uncool at that time. And we concentrated in classic, original things, whatever our customers wanted. Also at that time, most stores in Southgate wouldn't welcome Black or Latino shoppers. So we were the place where people could come in and get treated like a lady or a gentleman based upon the way they acted in the store, not by the way they were dressed or how they looked. Just given the benefit of the doubt until they proved us wrong.
Exactly, yeah. And so then the 80s?
And then the 80s, we again ignored fashion. That time was more of the parachute pants, and fortunately some of the 50 styles were available again, being reproduced, and in some of the 40s, retro was starting to come back, and we were working on a lot of Hollywood movies that they would come in for
period pieces. Name some of the movies.
Stand and Deliver, American Me, Bound by Honor, Blood In, Blood Out, Driving Miss Daisy, The Green Mile, The Idolmaker, The Sandlot.
So a lot of movies. How does that make you?
Hundreds of movies.
How does that make you feel? I mean, this is a what we call a niche, right? In which, you know, your father, who came up with the idea to actually go out and buy up all these old clothes and cater to the 40s and 50s look.
That was strictly my father. His father wanted to be up to date onto the fashion, and my father did the same thing in the 50s. He designed the number one selling pant in the United States, the A1 Pegger, in the early 50s. He was designing for Hollywood Rambler, which was a shirt company similar to Sir Guy that had a lot of rayon flannel short sleeve shirts and some pretty nice designs. And he loved those eras. And when it started turning into worn out Levi's with holes and patches in it, and, you know, cheap polyester material that, you know, really wasn't elegant, he went up and bought all the wools and cottons that nobody wanted. Not that he felt there was going to be a retro market or there was going to be, you know, opportunity to wardrobe movies, because the movie houses at that time, the studios, had huge wardrobes. And there was never a thought of them going outside for it. It was just his instinct that said, cotton, good cotton has a value. Good wool has a value. The workmanship that went into it has a value. So even though there's no market for it, except for a few people that want to dress Zoot Suit or Pachuco, there was really no smart reason at that time. No one else thought of doing it, but he just felt it was the right thing to do. And the fact that it was devalued at that time and he could pick it up relatively inexpensive was all the more reason it was a tempting process. And then the movie, the play Zoot Suit, came out. And all of a sudden, it brought back a revival within the Latino community of the Zoot Suit era and the Pachuco look and style. And then the movie studio started dismantling, and their wardrobe departments got dismantled as well. And when you're shooting a movie and you need six of the same thing, you're not going to find it in a movie wardrobe or in a thrift store. My father had it. He bought out, you know, thousands of things at a time.
Mm-hmm. That's very, very interesting. Now, the fashion of the 40s was I guess, very baggy and wide ties, correct?
That's correct. Wide lapels, baggy pants, full shoulders, wide brims on the hats, wide bottoms on the pleated pants. It was a very baggy era.
And let's talk a little bit about shoes. You know, I remember the Oxford Navy shoes in which, you know, a lot of the army surplus after the World War II, a lot of these shoes were around, and a lot of people started buying the patent leather shoes, which were very cheap and inexpensive.
That dictated fashion, especially among some of the poor people, that there was army surplus goods. It was good quality. It was inexpensive. And like the Dickies fit into that. My father was the first store to bring Dickies to California. That in 1944, he met somebody in basic training whose mother worked at the Dickey factory. And he saw the pants they're wearing, and they were mostly just making things for the government at that time. And they didn't sell anyone west of Texas. And he got this guy to get his mother to send the first group of Dickies out to our store in Watts in 1944.
Wow.
And yeah, so street fashion back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, even the 80s was very practical. It was something that was usually workwear. Sometimes even jail clothes. And it was something that people got good value out of, good wear, that they could preserve and maintain and look proper in. And that was a big consideration. And in the 90s, it changed to just labels and fashion.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk about the Stacy Adams shoes. How long have these been around?
I don't know when Stacy Adams first started, but they were around in the 40s, and they carried throughout today, like the wingtips and the cap toes. Some people call them biscuits, some of the boots. And I wish they were making more things. As a matter of fact, in the 1990s, they stopped carrying many of their two-tone combinations in the wingtips and the cap toes and some of the colors in the patent leather, and all of a sudden started making their quality a little less than they used to make them, and started making them offshore. And we went and started making things like they used to make, the quality that they used to make, and colors primarily. We're really not trying to go into competition with Stacy Adams, but where they dropped the ball and wouldn't go back and take care of their customers, we went and started making the shoes they should have been making in better quality in Mexico.
Wow, that's interesting that, you know, there is a market and that people are still willing to buy the clothes and the shoes that they grew up with.
Yes, that's true. I was having a discussion with somebody yesterday who makes high-quality chains, and he tried to sell them in a swap meet, and no one would pay for the quality and the time and the workmanship that he invested in the chains. And that's the way things are going today. In the Targets, everyone wants cheaper and cheaper. And what I told him is that the younger generation today is going to see the way that their older teenage brothers or sisters are spending little money on things that don't last. The quality is bad, and it's really a poor investment. And then they see other people paying $320 for jeans that are not good quality. They might have an interesting stitching or something on the back, but it isn't good value. That I predict that the next generation will want quality and value because it's cheaper in the long run. And that's what we've tried to maintain is the quality and the value of the 1940s and 50s and 60s and in our items, and Stacy Adams hasn't maintained, and other companies have, and some companies like Pendleton have.
And that brings us to Pendleton. Now, this is a very interesting and long story, and there is an article in Street Low magazine. I believe it's issue 56.
That's correct, yeah.
And this article, I mean, because I grew up with Pendletons. All my brothers, all the barrio, everybody wore Pendletons, you know? And I never understood the history of it, and it's kind of amazing once you read this article that the article Pendleton was a company out in Oregon, correct?
Oh, yeah.
And they...
Pendleton, Oregon. They had a mill.
Exactly. And they actually... patented or copyrighted Native American designs.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And that's very important because, you know, us Chicanos, Mexican Americans, what you call Latinos, we are of indigenous descent. And so I guess we gravitate and are pulled to that which is familiar to us, even if we don't even remember that it's ours. you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so then the colors, the patterns, I mean, we love the shirts. And, you know, lately I started finding out through Native student programs here at the University of California, Riverside, that they actually made blankets. Now, I didn't know that. I found out here. And then when I read the article, I made the connection that these were the same people making the Pendletons.
Yes, and they are basically highly respected by the Native Americans for the quality and designs of their blankets.
And it is quality. Now these Pendleton, I guess they call them boardwalk shirts. Yeah, are expensive, but it is fine, what we call virgin wool, ¿verdad?
Yes, that's right. But you take care of it, you have a shirt for 15, 20 years, which comes out cheaper than most things you would buy in your local department store.
Now, there was also another article that came out in Lowrider Magazine. Do you know the issue and or printing of that one?
Well, we've been featured in Lowrider Magazine twice in the last year. October 2009, they did an article on Greenspans and history and significance in the Chicano community here. And it was written by Edgar Hoyle, and he did his research and talked to some of our old-time customers that he knew from the community and was able to paint a picture of the significance of Greenspans over the generations in the community.
Mm-hmm. And so is there a link? Now, you have a website, correct?
Yes, we have a website. It's greenspans.com. And these articles, you can Google Greenspans Lowrider Magazine or Lowrider Magazine Greenspans, and these links will come up to the Lowrider Magazine website that shows the article of Greenspans, the store, and also the Greenspan Classic Car Show that took place last March in Southgate Park.
All right. Now, there was a fire, I remember, in your store a while back, because I remember my brother went out and bought a Zoot Zoot from you, I think, right before the fire. And that was, what, in 88, 89, something like that?
That was in 93. What was interesting is... there was an uprising on the street in 92, and word on the street was, don't bother Greenspans. And our store was respected, and we didn't have any problems, and many other stores did. And then 1 year later, 4th of July weekend, some kids playing with fireworks caught the store on fire through a freak succession of events, and we had a fire that was a big problem. We lost a third of our merchandise. A third of our merchandise got slight damaged slightly, and a third got preserved. And it was 1% structural damage, and we had a good 3 to 6 month remodeling job ahead of us. Unfortunately, our clientele was viewed by some in the city at that time as unwanted, gang-related, unwanted minorities. And as a matter of fact, one city official said to my father, "Well, you sell gangster clothes too, don't you?" And he said, "I don't know what kind of people your grandfathers and uncles were, but we're selling the same kind of clothes they were."
Good response. Good response.
So, but our 3 month, 3 to 6 month remodeling job took 6 years, and we couldn't sell clothes in our location, even though it was deemed safe, and we would receive $1,000 a day fine to do that. So we opened up across the street and invented a new style of retailing, which is selling clothes without showing them. That someone would say would come in for a zoot suit, and we'd be across the street from where we stored our things in our store, and we'd ask them 10 questions and do some measurements, and in about 2-3 minutes, that suit would appear from across the street.
Good. That's really good.
And our customers were patient and understanding enough that they hung in there with us during that time instead of us going under, like some in the city at that time would have liked.
Right. Correct. Now, you also have a big section of hats, fedora hats. And why the attraction also to hats?
Well, it's everything classic. I mean, our customers like them. We bought out old hat stores as they were going out of business in downtown L.A., the New York Hat Store. In downtown Long Beach, there was a store also with the same name, the New York Hat Store. There was stores downtown called Lori's or the Fair, which were very similar to us. They would carry a lot of the same product we did, but on Main Street in downtown L.A., and they went out of business, and we ended up with a lot of original hats made in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and there were still companies through the 80s making these hats, and it's just what our customers liked, and we always listened to what our customers liked and tried to get it to them at good quality at a fair price. And what started happening in the 80s is all of these hat styles started to get discontinued, especially in the straws. So we went around the country from hat company to hat company buying out their old merchandise, and some hat companies were going out of business at that time. And we had a huge, huge inventory of discontinued style hats. And people would travel 50, 100 miles to buy these hats from us. What happened is we started running out of these hats. And that's where we started producing our own products. We went back to the original factories that made them for these companies and got them to make them to us to the same specifications.
Wow. That's very interesting. Now, tell me the history of the hat itself. I mean, you know, at some point people just stopped wearing them, and I think that was with the invention of the baseball cap?
Well, in our store, we never stopped selling them. The hats were very popular in the 40s, 50s, 60s. Some gentlemen from Mexico have worn hats their whole life. And then really around the 1970s, hats really weren't fashionable except for maybe what people would call pimp hats today. In the 1980s, it was an old man's item. Young people really didn't wear hats unless they liked to dress like the 30s, 40s, 50s. Going out, you know, Bonnaroo, suited and booted. We continued to sell them. And then the baseball caps did come in big with a lot of the younger people. But And then hat stores started closing up. But we continued to sell what we knew, what our customers wanted, and that's the classic looks. But over the years, in the 40s and 50s, the brims were small, were big, excuse me. And then in the 1960s, you get into the small brims, what people called stingy brims. And then in the 70s, with the wide lapels and the long collars and the bell bottoms, you get into what people today call the pimp hats. But that was just basically, if someone wore a hat, it was a bigger brim. In the 1970s, and the Superfly and those kind of movies. And then by the 1980s, hats were just a retro kind of look for one group or another. The rockabilly group, the veteranos, the part of the cholo style, the pachuco style, some of the ska style. But in fashion, it was basically just non-existent.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I always thought that the brim and the hat was really for the sun, you know, to really cover you from the sun and from the beating of the sun, right? I mean, we got all kinds of ointments and lotions now for the sun to block all of that. But I still believe and think that the hat is the best way in which the you know, your scalp, your hair can still breathe because of the hat, and you're still covered with that brim covering your face from getting any sunburn. What I've noticed is a lot of people that have worn baseball caps throughout the years, they start going bald.
I don't know about any connection with that. I think you're just knowing older people now.
Oh. Well, it's my belief. I mean, I'm sticking with it.
No, but hats, a lot of people seem to be scared by them today if they didn't grow up with them and didn't have brothers, you know, that wore them and, you know, played around with their brothers' or father's hats. And they're just not comfortable with hats on. And, you know, a few times a week we have people come in the store that they've never worn a hat, and we have to find a hat that they're comfortable with, that fits their face right, that that they can be comfortable with. My father always said that clothing is like your skin. You can't wear someone else's skin. That you've got to have something that's yours, that's your skin, that you're comfortable with.
Exactly. Now, your father, and we don't have to get into a lot of detail here, he recently passed away.
Yes. He passed away on December 15th, 2009.
Well, I think is there anything else that you want to mention about your life?
Well, I think I've pretty much mentioned a lot. Maybe I can come back and talk more.
All right. So we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you for coming in.
I'm glad to come in. It's always good to see you, Beto Man.
All right. And that's going to do it for me. You've been listening to Chicano Highlights. We'll continue on another occasion with some more interviews. And hasta la próxima, raza. Ahí te guacho.